from Amsterdam in the Netherlands. I'm Suzak Roulat, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. And welcome to Worldviews. OU Vice President for Student Affairs and Dean of Students, Clark Stroud, joins me again on our European tour to discuss European parliamentary elections and the concept of Euroscepticism.
It'll be interesting to see, how things settle out, especially as countries that have been immigrants are not immigrants anymore. They're all a part of the same community.
And later, I'll talk about religious fragmentation and divisions in Islam with UCLA historian Niall Green.
It can be very confusing for ordinary people trying to understand what Islam is, because the many different voices will be saying, yes, jihad is legitimate, or no, the real Islam is peaceful and it has no jihad. So what is the real Islam?
We'll put Islam into the context of global history after this hour's news from NPR. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzak Roulat. I'm here again with Clark Stroud. We are finishing a four-country tour of Europe. We're in our last leg here. Clark, thanks for joining me again.
Great to be with you.
Well, one of the interesting things that we've been experiencing while we've been here the past couple of weeks is watching the Europeans in these different countries that we visited prepare for their upcoming parliamentary elections. And we hear it everywhere that they're saying these elections are important, they're different, there's more power in the European Parliament these days. And so everybody's really paying attention to these elections. But there's a lot of Euroscepticism, too. We can see it everywhere we've been. Europeans that are very skeptical about the EU, obviously still suffering from financial crisis, austerity measures, unemployment, concerns are really on the rise.
Yeah, it's been really interesting as we talk to different people and look at the dynamics in the media here. And interestingly, looking at the countries that seem to be pushing away from their opinions on being in the Eurozone and what that means, especially from those who are, under the most pressure, like Greece and Portugal, Ireland, and the UK even. We're just seeing, the far right is really, really taking control. And I wouldn't be surprised to see them gain some seats in this election.
Well, I think, as you mentioned, the far right, I mean, the far right parties are those that are wanting to weaken the power of the European Union. And that we're seeing everywhere we go, people are predicting that the far right will gain some ground. And this is kind of interesting in how that plays into the Russian hands in some ways. I mean, the press has been suggesting, for example, that Russia too wants to try to roll back some of the power of the EU and obviously stop the spreading of the EU into its former territories. And so there's a lot in common between the Russian government and these political parties on the far right in Europe that want to weaken the European Union further. I mean, is this kind of ironic or what?
Yeah, it is. And one of the things that we got to do on this trip with students was visit NATO. And so just even moving from kind of the economic impact of the Eurozone and what's happening over here, looking at NATO and just even the Russian sphere of NATO is NATO and moves towards countries that were historically in the Warsaw Pact or a part of the former USSR. I think that they really see an opportunity here for a weakened Eurozone here.
Well, we'll definitely be watching this with interest as we see the outcome next week and as we continue to look toward how the European Union is going to change. I mean, you mentioned visiting NATO. We also visited the European Commission. I mean, there's a lot of, I think, optimism and enthusiasm in some ways within the European Commission about the importance of that institution. And we heard over and over again, I mean, we didn't just hear Euroscepticism on this trip. We did hear people say, look, these countries are far too small to be able to be independent. They can't separate. There's no reason why we should disintegrate. You know, this institution should disintegrate or anyone should be kicked out because it's so incredibly important in terms of being able to compete in the global economy and this global market. They're just too small to engage in the global market otherwise.
Yeah, and I think as they struggle, this is a continent that's been warring with itself for, over 2,000 years over culture and religion and economics and whatever. But finding the delta between kind of the sovereignty and the nationalism of these countries and coming together into a larger, organized and powerful unit. And I agree. I think there is a lot of optimism as well. And I think there's actually even some kind of EU type nationalism. You know, we see a lot more EU flags flying and people talking about being a part of this larger community.
Well, one of the things that's certainly interesting to see is the young people. I mean, the young people suffer from significant unemployment in these countries, as high in some countries as 60%. That's young people between the ages of 15 and 24. And so that's really hard for us to imagine, anywhere from 25 to 60% unemployment. But yet they're the ones that really benefit from being able to move around without any major barriers to be able to go from one country to another and work in another country. So it'll be very interesting to see how the younger population votes in these upcoming elections.
Absolutely. It's great to see that with the frontiers open and people being able to move freely around. It'll be interesting to see, you know, how things settle out, especially as countries that have been immigrants are not immigrants anymore. They're all a part of the same community.
All right. Well, Clark, we are ending our tour, and it's been an interesting one. Thank you so much for joining me here on Worldviews and in Europe.
Thank you very much.
We'd love to hear your thoughts about this conversation or answer any questions you may have. You can get a hold of us through Twitter at WorldviewsKGOU or at Suzek Rolat, and on the Worldviews page of our website, kgou.org. Next, I'll talk with UCLA historian Niall Green about his work placing Islam into the context of global history. I'm Suzek Rolat, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzek Rolat. My guest, Niall Green, started his career studying the history of Islam in India and Pakistan. He then branched out to explore the religion's activity through the Middle East and in Muslim diasporas in Europe, America, and Japan. He's the author of the 2012 book, Sufism, A Global History, and is currently writing about how the first Iranian students to study in Europe in the early 19th century shaped modern Middle Eastern and European relations. Niall Green, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be here.
Well, Niall, you've done such interesting work on the subject of Islam in world history. And your purpose, as you've said in your work, is to kind of place Islam in world history. What do you mean by that, and why? Why do we need to do that?
In terms of what motivated me, really, I think it was desire when I was growing up just to, like many teenagers, get away from home as far as I possibly could. And in my case, that was getting a train to Istanbul when I was 17. And then from there on onwards, as I started to travel through the Arab Middle East and then to India and to Iran and ultimately Pakistan and many other places, into Islamic Africa and elsewhere too, I gradually realized that the Muslim world wasn't its center wasn't the Middle East. And in fact, the Middle East is in many ways demographically a minority part of the Muslim world, or at least the larger Muslim populations in the world. So I became more interested in South Asia, in India, Pakistan, and also Afghanistan. And these are the regions where we do have a much larger Muslim population than we do in the Middle East. Countries like, as I say, India, Pakistan, Bangladesh. I mean, we have a much larger population than the entirety of the Middle East placed together. And the vast majority of the Muslim world was also the colonial world in the 19th century. So one really can't understand the roots of the Muslim experience of modernity or indeed of globalization without placing in colonialism into that picture. But what I've tried to do in my work over the years is to understand things like colonization and like globalization that have usually been seen from the European side of that political process or that larger process of the discovery of a wider world and other cultures, but see that through the Muslim experience, through the languages that I studied, Persian, Urdu, and so on, and then to try to find materials, particularly travel writings written in these languages of traveling to different parts of the world, or otherwise in many cases religious works, and trying to understand how Islam or various different kinds of Islam, various different what I call entrepreneurs of new Muslim firms create different types, different brands, if you like, different Muslim products, different Muslim ideologies, different Muslim services in some ways, to respond to the new kinds of demand, cultural demands, religious demands, social demands that modernization, the globalization, and in the 19th century, the colonization created for ordinary Muslims around these many parts of the world.
Well, I want to get back to the notion of Muslim brands and entrepreneurs here in just a second. But some of your early work was focusing on Sufism as and kind of from a global historical perspective. And in this work, you refer to Sufism, or what you prefer, I think, to call customary Islam versus kind of modernist or reformist Islam. Can you kind of just put that into context for us and then relate that perhaps to this notion of Muslim marketplaces and brands and the entrepreneurship? Because I think that's kind of where you're getting at it from, you know, from that perspective, modern versus kind of traditional or customary. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, I think when ordinarily when we read about Sufism, we hear about Sufism, we see it packaged in a way that it's almost sometimes described as the mystical sect of Islam, the mystical branch, sometimes seen as it were, the more liberal aspect of Islam. And it's often, I think, seen to be very much, as it were, a minority part of Islam. What I see as a historian in books I've written, like my book Sufism, A Global History, I try to show that in fact, when we look at the way in which the Muslim faith expanded throughout the world from its early Middle Eastern core in the early period through into what's now India and then beyond into what's now Indonesia, Malaysia, and throughout Africa as well. It's really through the Sufi brotherhoods, the Sufi shrines of the Sufis that are the places of pilgrimage, a popular pilgrimage and miracle working, the saints of Islam as well, who are Sufi saints, that it's these figures, this Sufi Islam, as I prefer to call it, rather than Sufism, which sounds as if it's somehow separate from Islam. It's this Sufi Islam that becomes really the normative, in a sense, the orthodox Islam for most ordinary Muslims worldwide until really the modern period. And it's when we reach around 1800, scholars debate whether this is beginning in the 18th century before the impact of European ideas of religion, often European Protestant ideas of religion, or the other argument is this really happens in the 19th century during the colonial period. But we do get self-conscious reformists of Islam who are trying to create an Islam that is more modern, more rational, sometimes more liberal in terms of women's rights, women's education, more amenable to scientific interpretations, opposed to saints and miracles and ideas that are seen as being, or religious claims that are seen as being superstitious. So reformist Islam, which in many ways I think when we meet most Muslims in the West nowadays, their version of Islam is what they see as ordinarily just this is Islam, is really this reformist Islam that has developed in a particular historical period and that has often defined itself against Sufi Islam as being backward, superstitious. So what I'm trying to see in many ways is that the Islam, as it were, of a pre-modern globalization was this Sufi Islam. But through the more modern experience of globalization in the colonial period through to the present day, Muslims have grappled with, as I say, science on the one hand of often missionary and colonial critiques of their religion as being backward and superstitious on the other hand, and have created, through these figures I call religious entrepreneurs, through the founding of new religious firms, new religious organizations, if you like, that in many cases were reactions to and adaptations of the methods of the Christian missionaries themselves and their organizations and their means of propagation through vernacular printing, through preaching, through proselytizing. So these new reformist religious firms have been adopting in many ways the techniques of Western religious firms, we call them missionaries, and using those to spread and propagate a new, sometimes more liberal, sometimes more self-consciously rational, and modern version of Islam. But ultimately, what I see this is what this has created is a much more fragmented religious marketplace of Islams in which we have increasingly different numbers of what ordinary the news media or other scholars might call kind of sects and sectarian violence, sectarian competition. But what I see, prefer to see really through a sociological and anthropological reading as these different competing organizations with their different brands, their different forms of Islam, their different religious claims and services they provide, some miraculous, some anti-miraculous, some in terms of social networking and finding jobs and employment, some in terms of finding educational services, some in terms of providing services that are perhaps more traditional or customary in terms of religious music or, again, as I say, miracles or pilgrimage cults, some just forms of socialization. But these various different forms of Islam, I think, in sociological terms, really need to be seen not just as abstract forms, but as real organizations, religious firms, with their distinct leaderships and indeed their distinct entrepreneurs that promote them. So, my way of understanding Islam as a historian who's been very much influenced by anthropology, not least by my own experience in the field in many, many Muslim contexts, is really to see religion as operating in a way that is not distinct from other forces in the social world. So my sense of religion, it's a form of social organization and a claim to social power that need to be analyzed in a way that's unique to religion. So I think that, you know, there's a great difference between understanding religions theologically, when one's trying to understand their truth claims, their internal value. And I think that's fine and can be very useful. But that's not what I do. I'm trying to understand their place and means of operation in the social world, in which, unlike, let's say, a theological approach, religion doesn't need to be treated in a special and distinct way from any other form of organization, whether commercial or political.
I'm speaking with UCLA historian Niall Green about his work to place Islam into the context of global history. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. I'm Suzette Gralat, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gralat, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. My guest is UCLA historian Niall Green. When we left off, he said he studies the history of Islam to gain a social understanding of the religion rather than a theological one. Let me just be clear then. When you say religious entrepreneurs, who are these people exactly? Are these just your, I guess you would equate them to, say, your church leaders? They're your leaders of the mosque? They're the clerics? They're basically those that are leading these firms or organizations as organizations. So they're not just theologians and they're not just practitioners of a particular faith, but they are perpetuating and moving forward a particular institution that, you know, wants to survive and move forward into the future, as most institutions want to do, and that this is a result of the modern period and globalization. Is that kind of where you're coming from?
Yeah. So I think when we look, if we sort of move back the clock to a period, let's say around 1800, for the sake of argument, at that period, religious authorities, religious leaders in that period, even let's say religious entrepreneurs in that period, are going to be typically from a fairly narrow background. They would either be figures we would call the ulama, so that's to say the learned, as it were, in a sense, the clergy from a Muslim context, who would be, let's say, you know, their claims to authority would have been through their education and mastering the core religious text, the Quran, the sayings of the Prophet Muhammad, the Hadith, and so on. The other types of religious leadership or authority would be coming from the Sufi brotherhoods, and their claims to authority would be through their claims of mystical proximity, of coming close, of having a personal closeness, a personal friendship, as they called it, with God, which would give them not only authority, but as it were, miraculous powers as well. So in that sense, around 1800, the means of religious authority, of expressing religious authority, and indeed the social roots to using religious power, are coming from a fairly narrow set of backgrounds, from either an ulama type of background, perhaps being trained in a madrasa, or a Sufi background, being trained in a Sufi lodge, a Sufi khanaka, as they're called. From 1850 approximately onwards, or indeed from 1800 in my example, but really it speeds up from 1850 and speeds up increasingly through to the present day, a much, much wider social array of these entrepreneurial figures, as to say figures who are using religion for social authority or whatever other rationales they have, whatever other motivations they have, can come from a far wider range of backgrounds. They might not necessarily be them from, let's say, a Sufi or an ulama background. In the 20th century, one of the things we've seen in particular is the rise of journalists. Many religious leaders in the 20th century, such as Abu Ala Maududi, the founder of the Jamiat Islami, one of the world's largest Islamist organizations, was a journalist by training. And we see kind of, as it were, access to the public sphere, access to new means of communication, allowing, as it were, these figures from journalistic backgrounds to be much more entrepreneurial in terms of finding audiences and finding followers. But other types of entrepreneurs might be from a much wider range of backgrounds, perhaps religious leaders, perhaps business leaders. In other cases, figures who have actually been trained by Christian missionaries, and indeed were adapting in the 19th century in some ways through to the present day, adapting the techniques of Christian missionaries, often being their, as it were, their local helpers, translators, printers, and so on, and then learning new modes of religious propagation to become entrepreneurs in a different way. And what that's created then is a much wider range of possible social backgrounds that can create religious entrepreneurs, that can produce religious authority. And in turn, that's created then what I've called, as it were, a fragmentation of the religious landscape, of the religious economy, when we have far more competing what one might call sects, but what I would call religious firms, each with their entrepreneurs and leaders. And I think that's in many ways what underlies in terms of what we see in terms of sectarian violence in some contexts. And of course, in other places, there is, as it were, peaceful means of competition as well. Islam in America, when we actually look at Islam in America or in a context like Britain, where I'm from, or mainland Europe, when we actually look behind the idea that there are these all Muslims, what we actually find are actually a range of religious firms and organizations, each with their leaders, with their different rationale. And that's why I think it can be very confusing for ordinary people trying to understand what Islam is, because the many different entrepreneurs and different voices will be saying, yes, jihad is legitimate. Or another religious leader saying, no, the real Islam is peaceful and it has no jihad. So what is the real Islam? Well, my take as a social historian and as it were, as an anthropologist, is to say, well, there is no real Islam around this other than the various articulations that are made by these different self-described, self-made spokesmen, the entrepreneurs. And I think, again, that's why I think it's tremendously important to understand the social organization behind what otherwise just seemed to be a very kind of a muddy field of many different Islams, and it's not clear which one we should say, okay, that's the one.
Well, this muddy field, and I just want to end here, is do you see that we're starting to see that part of the world with new eyes, with new perspectives, and understanding all the things that you've just told us about the kind of muddy picture out there?
I think so. I think certainly in the last 10 years, I mean, obviously after the many tragic events in various parts of the world post 9/11, I think the good thing that has come out of it is a much more wider awareness and a more greater interest among non-Muslims and Muslims about promoting tolerant dialogue and understanding. And I think in many ways, one of the most important things there has been art-related projects. And of course, we have to understand that Islam and religion is only one aspect of the life of Muslims. And of course, obviously, Muslims worldwide have cultural lives, literary lives, family lives, many other multiple dimensions of their full human potentialities. And I think in that way, that's one of the things that I've tried to do is working on the literature of Afghanistan to provide a counter-narrative towards the picture of Talibanization. And a book I co-edited with the Afghan journalist Nushin Ababzada a couple of years ago called Afghanistan in Ink tried to show that rather than Afghanistan as being really a country just of Islam and of the Taliban, but has this very rich literary history that behind the story of Khalid Hosseini and the kite runner, there's this very rich literary tradition that is still ongoing today. So I think it's really very important that even though I'm really a historian of religion, I think, you know, I would be the first person to say, well, religion is only one part of the broader picture of Muslim lives.
Well, now, Green, thank you so much. We could go for many more minutes, but that's all the time we have today. But thank you so much for being with us on Worldviews.
Thank you for inviting me.
You've been listening to my conversation with UCLA historian Niall Green. You can read the entire first chapter of his book, Sufism, A Global History, on our website, kgou.org. KGOU produces Worldviews through a collaborative partnership with the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. Brian Hardzinski produces the show, and Nick Aguilera prepared the research for this interview. For Clark Stroud, I'm Suzette Grelott.